Decatur Memorial Hospital, and HSHS St. Mary's Hospital are proud to bring you tonight's broadcast, Opioids, a Community Conversation, only on News Talk 1340 WSOY AM, 103.3 FM, streaming live at NowDecatur.com, and a special Facebook Live broadcast on NowDecatur.com's Facebook page. And now your host, Brian Byers.
Those listening on WSOY 1340 AM, 103.3 FM, viewing on the Now Decatur Facebook page, or streaming live on the Now Decatur app, we welcome you to Opioids, a Community Conversation, jointly presented by Decatur Memorial Hospital and HSHS St. Mary's Hospital. We'd also like to express our gratitude to our host tonight, Millikan University, and the use of this room inside their glorious new University Commons building. For the next 60 minutes, we will hear from experts from healthcare, social services, and law enforcement about a crisis that started in the late 90s, but has spiraled in the last few years to the point that in 2015, opioid overdose deaths surpassed deaths by car accidents and guns combined. On October 26th, the President of the United States declared it a public health emergency. It's been fueled by the drug industry, the United States Congress, narco trafficking by the cartels in Mexico, fentanyl from China, and a growing dependence on pain-free health care. It's in our schools, it's in our churches, it's in our places of business, and it turns ordinary citizens into criminals and clogs our jails and courts. It's a global, continental, national, and local problem. Tonight is just an opening salvo and a much larger conversation about what the community is capable of doing to stem the tide. Let me first start by introducing our panel. Please hold your applause until I've introduced the entire group. From my left and your right, Dr. John Furry, Director of St. Mary's Pain Medicine Center. Joan Kaufman, President and CEO of HSHS St. Mary's Hospital. Dr. Ted Clark, Medical Director of the DMH Emergency Care Center. Tim Stone, President and CEO of Decatur Memorial Hospital. Jay Scott, Macon County State's Attorney. Chief Jim Getz, Decatur Police Department. Sheriff Howard Buffett, Macon County Sheriff's Office. Debbie Bogle, Executive Director of the United Way. Tanya Andrix, Director of Crossings Healthcare. Candy Clevenger, Director of the Heritage Behavioral Health Center. Dr. Joe Carter, Associate Professor of Nursing, Millikan University. And Mary Garrison, Professor of Social Work, Millikan University. First, a couple of facts before we get to the big picture. According to national statistics, roughly 21 to 29% of patients prescribed opioids for chronic pain misuse them. Between 8 and 12% develop an opioid use disorder, and an estimated 4 to 6% who misuse prescription opioids transition to heroin. Nearly 80% of people who use heroin for the first time first misused prescription opioids. With these sobering facts, I want to start the conversation with Sheriff Buffett, who's done work around the globe with this, and start, if we could, Sheriff, from a global perspective before we boil it down to local.
Yeah, well, what's happening locally is actually a result of what's happening nationally and internationally. So it's hard to disconnect it, although everyone sitting here will ultimately be trying to solve the problem in Decatur, Illinois, and Macon County. And I'll start by saying I was standing down by the border between the U.S. and Mexico one time with one of Chief Getz's detectives, and I said, well, there's ground zero. That's where, you know, it all ends, when the Border Patrol intercepts drugs coming across this country. And he looks at me and he says, no, that's where it starts. It ends in Decatur, Illinois, or Canton, Ohio, or wherever you want to go. So the idea that we're somehow disconnected from any of that is completely wrong. I think on the international scene, there's a lot of things you could talk about, but I think the most important two that are going to affect us going forward is cocaine production has soared in Colombia, and most of that it comes across either through Mexico or on the water. On the water, our Coast Guard is completely unable to deal with that threat, and I got lots of details, but I won't go into them, take too long, but it's a serious and significant threat, and it's probably going to get worse. That is something that will flow into this country in greater and greater amounts and more difficult to intercept. The one that is really ought to scare everybody in this room is Mexico. Mexico looks a lot like an early development of Afghanistan, and that's a fact. They are growing more poppies today. As we legalize marijuana in the United States, they are taking thousands of acres of marijuana out of production, and they're putting poppies into production. So they are now the number one heroin, and have been for a while, but they are clearly the number one heroin producer for what comes into this country. I think the most important thing that I think about law enforcement is that when I say it looks like Afghanistan, when you start growing poppies, it's very hard to stop growing them. It becomes something that is very hard to change. So not only do they look like Afghanistan in the sense of the drugs are starting to grow, but they are in a study that came out very recently, the second most violent country in the world behind Syria. And people don't understand that. If you could get a hold of the Haida reports, which typically go to law enforcement, there are many sites on there you can go to and see people being butchered, literally, just like you would think that ISIS does. The cartels do it in Mexico, and they do it in the most vicious way that you can imagine. So the heroin and fentanyl production in Mexico is soaring, and it's coming into this country in a number of different ways. 50 to 70% of Mexico is now controlled by the cartels. What does that mean? It means the corruption has crossed into this country significantly. If you look, you don't read about this in Illinois, but if you look at the sheriffs, the police chiefs, and the politicians that are in prison today across Texas, primarily Texas, but also some in Arizona, it's mind-boggling, and they've made deals with the cartel. They're bringing the law enforcement and politicians are helping bring the drugs into this country because the amount of money is extraordinary. And so they are bribing people in this country just like they are everywhere else. And there was a recent DEA report a few weeks ago that had specifics about how the Zeta cartel, the Gulf cartel, where they're operating in Texas today. So that when the cartels get that kind of power in this country, it becomes impossible for us to deal with it at a local level because the flow is significant. Nationally, I would just say that, and I hate to pick on millennials, I'll probably get in trouble here, but you know, you hear them say we want conflict diamonds, we want free trade coffee, we want positive social impact. It is amazing to me how people believe in that. But they'll say recreational marijuana is okay. There is no such thing that drugs are a victimless crime. You are supporting a cartel that is the most vicious and nasty organizations in the world. They're as bad as any terrorist organization. They are a terrorist organization. So the idea that by purchasing drugs, it's okay and it's some victimless crime, that is not true. And people have to understand that it's not true. And I just throw one more thing in there to wrap up real quick is it is also amazing to me that we criticize other countries for such corruption. And I call it legalized corruption. When you can hire 42 DEA agents, 33 of them out of the same area that regulate pharmaceutical companies and distributors, and you can hire them as consultants and lobbyists, and you hire them out of those positions to go to work for you so that you can figure out a way to kill more people in this country. To me, that's legalized corruption. And that is, we have to tackle that, and we have to tackle it at every level, including here locally.
Thank you, Sheriff Buffett. To the hospital CEOs, Joan, you worked before moving here in Wisconsin on Governor Walker's task force. What were you able to do there?
I really credit Governor Walker with having the foresight to put together a group of just a coordinated group of individuals across the state in various constituencies that really worked to help advise and assist him in really getting our arms around opioid access, care, treatment, and prevention. Within a year of having that task force put together, and for me, I was the president and CEO of St. Joseph's Hospital at the time, and we had 46 of the 86 identified inpatient detoxification beds in the entire state of Wisconsin. I served on the Wisconsin Hospital Association, which is also by virtue of that role how I became a member of the task force. He had it led by the lieutenant governor as well as John Nygren, one of the representatives in the Marinette County area, whose daughter had suffered from an overdose of methamphetamines. She had been introduced to opioids at a very early age and at an appropriate time for healthcare services, and unfortunately became addicted. So he really took an active role in helping to advance education around this topic. But I think what's important about Governor Walker is the structure that he put in place. He made sure that all of those key constituents, whether it was education, law enforcement, health care, the department, county health departments, everybody that really, the physicians, the medical society in the state of Wisconsin, all were at the table to help work together to figure this out. And within 1 year, he had signed in 17 executive orders to advance public policy around prevention, education, awareness, and treatment.
Tim Stone from DMH, comparing that to Illinois, I am told we're not nearly as bad off as Ohio or New Hampshire or West Virginia, but that is moving west, and there's more to come. What are we doing in Illinois right now?
So not necessarily to sound like Ross Perot, but I have a chart. This chart was recently issued by CMS last week. And while narrowly speaking, it focuses on Medicare Part D, Illinois is one of the lowest states prescribing opioids in the union, much lower than Indiana, Michigan, or Wisconsin. So that's the good news. Mm-hmm. And specifically, closer to home, Decatur actually tracks with the rest of the state. So the doctors are doing a pretty good job in terms of not going too far in terms of prescribing opioids as a pain management.
I will tell you, 2 years ago, I had a surgical experience, and when I was checking out and I was handed hydrocodone, I never opened the bottle. It's still sitting in a medicine cabinet 2 years later because I had this thing in my brain to you know, I don't know whether I have the personality type that could be addicted in 3 days, but some people can. What are we doing differently? And Dr. Furry and Dr. Clark, you know, how are physicians describing when to prescribe opioids? What are the guidelines?
Well, first of all, you screen patients for just what you said. Do you have an addictive personality? You screen them. Do you have a history of psychiatric illness? Those are susceptible populations. Do you have a history of criminal behavior? Another susceptible population of people who are likely to abuse and or misuse opioids. So the screening is very important. And then, of course, you need to know what are we treating, exactly what are we treating, and do they have a painful condition? Is it an ongoing painful condition? And so if that's established and you feel like opioids may be indicated, you still have to monitor very closely. What are we doing with the opioids? Are we making a difference that's positive? Is their quality of life going up, and is their function going up? If it's not, then we need to back off. So that there's a great deal of monitoring that goes in after someone goes on to an opioid.
Dr. Clark?
We have a different situation in the emergency department where we're meeting these people for the first time. And sure, we can try to collect our background information and have some questions regarding their potential for addiction, but oftentimes they're coming and they're presenting with a painful condition, and it's our nature as physicians to want to relieve that suffering. Opiates have always been a tool in our toolbox, and it's something that we have used. But I can look back just over the last 10 years from when I trained in residency till now, where when I trained, the teaching was if someone is in pain, you relieve that pain. And there wasn't really any thought of the consequences of what types of medications were used necessarily. We always gave the patients the benefit of the doubt. You say you're in pain, I believe you, I'm going to treat it, and I'm going to try to figure out where that pain's coming from. That has changed. We have to be much more careful now in the emergency department. We have to be more skeptical. And there are some bad side effects of that. It does change the relationship with the patient to some extent. But we have a lot of new tools now, and we're learning a lot more in terms of other ways to relieve pain other than opiates. We'll apply ice packs. We'll talk about topical creams. So we'll use other types of analgesics. But Dr. Furry and I were discussing at the beginning, prior to this starting, opiates are the quickest. They're the most effective for the relief of severe pain. So they will be something that we continue to use, but we're definitely expanding our set of skills as far as limiting their use.
Tanya from Crossings, can you address how you guys, how it works at Crossings?
Absolutely. The CDC has very clear guidelines on how to prescribe opioids, and it includes assuring, just like you all describe, making sure that you've tried other avenues to treat that pain. For example, if it's back pain, have you tried non-steroidals? Have you tried physical therapy or TENS unit? Before you give a prescription for pain medication. The other thing that the CDC recommends is that the prescriber check the state database. So there's a prescription monitoring database in every state. The state of Illinois has one. And so in our organization, before a prescriber can write for an opioid prescription, that database has to be checked. It is a cumbersome step. It takes about 5 to 10 minutes. However, that database tells you if that particular person has received an opioid from another prescriber in another part of the state and picked it up. You know, it helps you identify people who are shopping for narcotics. And so it allows the prescriber to have a little bit more faith in that prescription. And so we follow those steps. The last thing that the CDC recommends is that the patient sign a pain contract where the nurse actually explains to them the risks and benefits of that opioid, the risk of addiction, and then asks the patient to agree to pill counts and random urine drug screens with a 24-hour notice. And all of our patients have to abide by those specific criteria or they will not receive an opioid prescription. When we implemented that process, it was about 2 years ago, we had over 300 patients in our patient panel who were receiving opioids for chronic pain. Now we have 38.
So it's obviously worked.
It's allowed us to reduce the number of prescriptions and transition patients who were previously receiving opioids to a more appropriate pain management protocol.
Tim, has the government changed the way, I know that things are done on patient experience and surveys, and, you know, what does a pain-free experience mean, when it comes to hospitals?
Brian just asked a million-dollar question. So there's a lot of ongoing discussion about the timing of the crisis. And it seems to be somewhat coincidental that the crisis started when the value-based payment system was rolled out for hospitals, in which one of the HCAHPS metric from a customer satisfaction that determines part of what we get paid, or more appropriately, what we won't get paid if our scores aren't at a certain level, deals with pain management within the hospital. And there were a lot of professionals that had warned CMS and the federal government that by advocating, and the Joint Commission got on this bus as well, by advocating a pain-free experience in a hospital, that you effectively were kind of narrowing the scope of what type of drugs that one would have available to accomplish that very thing, that being the opioids. And there are those that believe that the timing of this, in terms of this explosion, is consistent when that program was rolled out. Now, recently, CMS has notified the healthcare industry that they are removing that from the value-based proposition, if you will. So there are those that believe that the federal government and poor public health policy has had a little bit to do with this.
It would certainly line up with the timeline. You know, these have been around since the 1990s, but it's only the last 6-7 years where it has exploded in numbers.
And I'll tell you one thing, Brian, that's caught my attention is the fact that we see the bad consequences of this in where Dr. Clark works in the emergency room. And during the past 12 months, we've had 122 overdoses of opioids in our ER. And here's the daunting thing. That age range runs from 12 years old to 80. So
that's an important note. Chief Getz, maybe if you could take this from a law enforcement perspective, is this any inner city? Is it rural? Are there age demographics? You know, what are you seeing every day on the street?
Yeah, I think we can no longer say it's not going to happen to us here in Central Illinois. It's not going to affect your family, but it does. It affects doctors, nurses, teachers. It's not just the junkie on the street or the person, that smokes marijuana every once in a while that decides to do some heroin. it's touching everybody. And I'll tell you a story, and I won't go into great detail, but it affected my police department about 3 months ago. I had a young officer about 4 or 5 years on the department, had a shoulder surgery several years ago. Some things came up, and we started to look into it. He had an addiction. He's no longer with us. He decided to get some help. But, I mean, when it's touching us at the police department, that tells you it can touch anywhere. So we're seeing it, and Dr. Stone hit on it, you know, from 12 years old to 80 years old. It is everywhere. And I know, Brian, you talked about that bottle in your medicine cabinet, you know, that's 2 years old. You know, that's some of the things we need to talk about. That kind of stuff needs destroyed because you don't want somebody that's visiting your house or if you've got kids over to grab that first pill or that second pill, and now it becomes something that they're addicted to. So,
and also from a law enforcement point of view, it's not just the crime of buying drugs or buying fentanyl or buying heroin. Now it's stealing money, too. I mean, it creates
absolutely
other crimes.
It's like everything else. At some point, you have to find a way to pay for those things, and that results in stealing from your own family members or going out and committing burglaries at night. Robbing people. I mean, it turns into something that you have to support. And if you're not working or you can't work because of your addiction, you have to get the money somewhere.
Sheriff Buffett, you told me about a 67-year-old grandmother being arrested for buying heroin on the street.
That was here in Decatur. I was with Detective Larner, and the chief's team was sitting on a buy house. And so we were a few blocks away. And we stopped this vehicle, and it was a 67-year-old woman. And I asked her, I said, are you a grandmother? Because I wanted to know, and she started crying. She said, yes. What she told us was it was the first time, and this could or may not be true, but, I mean, she said it was the first time she bought heroin because she couldn't get the opioids prescribed to her any longer, and a friend had told her how to do it. You know, when I was in Arizona, they arrested an 87-year-old man who was hauling drugs. We arrested a woman about a year ago here who actually, and it's funny, the indicators you get, but she was from Mount Zion at 2 a.m. She's buying alcohol down in a place where you wouldn't expect her to. So it piqued our interest. We got her stopped. She was buying alcohol to go out to engage in prostitution so she could pay for a heroin addict. And this is a woman who was teaching in a school where my son went to school. I mean, you can have every story you can imagine because it touches everything and everybody in some way.
And I think it's something, I was talking to another law enforcement person who had someone in his family recently, keep that private, but, you know, he said for 20 years, you know, he was black and white on the streets as a police officer until he saw in his home and his son, and it started out of a surgery, you know, and that addiction came about. We see it every day in life. Social services, Debbie Bogle, Tanya, and Mary from Milliken, what are you seeing out there? Maybe start with Debbie with United Way because you have such a large umbrella with so many other organizations underneath the United Way, but what are you seeing out there?
You know, what we're seeing, I mean, there's a lot of issues right now, and a lot of them do stem from drug abuse, and the trickle-down effect of that is huge in our community. Everything suffers from education. Mary can probably talk a little bit about homelessness, all of those things that are tied into it, and how do we fix those things while fixing this issue as well? And clearing all of that up together, there are a lot of things going on in our community that is really affecting. And child abuse, like you said, prostitution, all of these things that the wraparound services are available.
But much of that, the root cause can go back to drug addiction or mental yes. Health issues. And Mary, you teach here at Milliken. You know, are we preparing people in these fields, you know, for integrated care, mental health and substance abuse? I mean, are we setting the next generation, you know, out there with the skills they need, or do we need more of this?
I think Dr. Carter and I are doing the best job we can, but we need more resources as well. And if I can, I want to say a statistic here that when we talk about, of course, it cuts across all demographics. What we do know, too, is that vulnerable populations are at more risk. And so what we see is 30%, there's a 30% higher rate of death among homeless individuals with opioid addiction. And so we also know they're vulnerable. They don't have their basic needs being met. So we have that. We have Maslow's hierarchy of needs that we're not that we're facing. And we are trying to teach our students what that looks like. So from a mental health perspective, I know that my students are gaining that knowledge but they have to know. It's very different now than I went to school years ago. We have to know substance use and abuse as well, and addiction. We have to know that along with mental health because they go hand in hand. Individuals may be diagnosed with a mental health disorder and begin using addiction. They may not be diagnosed and begin using a substance. And so we know they're self-medicating at times. And so you're seeing a continued problem with that. And I know that, Joe, I don't know what you're seeing from the physical health side.
Well, it's not unusual with people with opioid disorders to somatize, meaning they'll develop physical symptoms as they crave and need a drug. And so that's usually how they present to healthcare. And opioid-dependent folks, they can't sort that through. I'm not sure they're entirely, when we talk about drug seeking, I'm not sure that they can sort through the fact that they're heavily dependent and that's what's causing their craving, or whether it's an actual physical problem that they're having. And it makes clinical recognition and diagnosis and screening, it makes it all very, very complicated and different and difficult. And so I like to talk to my students about what that means, that it may be that someone who's suffering from this disorder doesn't realize, doesn't have insight into this, and explains part of their behavior. And so to develop the skills to deal with that is difficult.
Is it possible for these frontline responders, whether it's in the ER, whether it's in the jail? You know, Sheriff and Chief Getz, I'm sure a lot of people that you're putting in jail, arresting for crimes, are suffering from drug addiction and mental issues. You know, how are your people prepared, you know, to deal with that?
I've tried to sell the jail to the chief, but he won't take it. It is an incredibly serious situation. We are, in a sense, and I hate to use this term, but in a sense, we are like the dumping ground for those who are addicts, those who have mental illness. We have people in our jail right now that I guarantee you we should not have in our jail. There is nowhere to take them. I've personally gone down and met with the folks at McFarland in Springfield to figure out if there's some way that we can make progress on this. As far as the drug addiction, we do have a program. We are getting some of the people help if we can defer their prosecution. We work with Jay on that very closely. We have a great drug court, which is a critical element in dealing with this issue locally. But I will tell you, the jail is a serious problem. And we're not prepared to deal with it. We're doubling the amount that we're going to spend on medical that we have historically. A lot of that deals with these very issues. But unfortunately, we are not in a situation where we have great solutions for what we're dealing with. And we realize, you know, this is an old phrase now, but we can't arrest our way out of it. We have people in jail that should not be in jail. They need help. They need to be in rehabilitation. We don't have the resources available in this community or even the communities around us to deal with it. Until we increase those resources, we're going to continue to treat people the wrong way. Okay, they're going to be in the wrong place for the wrong reason. And we're not going to help them get their life back together or give them an opportunity to get their life back together. It's a serious problem. The jail is a serious problem when it comes to this.
What about the court system, Jay? Can you maybe touch on what Howard mentioned there, and then also a new prosecutor that's going to be going after opioid dealers, not at the user level, but doesn't a society make a lot more sense to get somebody treated and get back to being a productive member of our community than putting them in jail?
Exactly. There's a misconception that our prisons are full of people who just got caught with a little bit of drugs, and that's not the way it is. First-time offenders, if they come up to our office, they're diverted out of the system and put into treatment so that they don't have a criminal conviction, which obviously can hang around and affect somebody's life for a very long time, the rest of their life. If they have a prior record and they have a drug problem, we get them into treatment as a part of probation. If that doesn't work, you know, the last step is the drug court that the sheriff mentioned, which is much more intensive. And the whole idea is try to treat them in the community, because if you warehouse them for what amounts to a few months in prison, they're going to get back out and they're still going to have the same addiction. So we try. Sometimes they don't let us do it. Of course, if people are out committing armed robberies, residential burglaries, things like that to get money for drugs, we can't do community-based sentences on those. But we do try everything we possibly can to get help. And the opioid prosecutor, like you mentioned, the whole idea is to go after the drug dealers. They're people that are making a lot of money off other people's misery. They don't care. So hopefully, thankfully, we got a grant from the Howard Buffett Foundation to provide for a very talented prosecutor and a paralegal and to try to take these people down because they're making a lot of money selling this stuff.
Are the ERs prepared, as prepared as they can be? I mean, when you have cases coming in, you know, overdosed, and then they're receiving, I forget the fentanyl or Narcan, and 30 minutes later they're leaving, you know, a drug overdose, you know, what happens after that? And I would like to turn the conversation maybe a little towards, you know, we've kind of established how we got here. Here we are. Are we communicating, you know, and did the president changing, you know, declaring this an emergency, does that clear anything up, make it easier to communicate? You know, my question would be, what happens to that overdose when they come into one of your ERs, they're revived, they leave, go right back to the world they came from? Is anyone following up with them? Is there any referral of services? Do all of the different organizations know what each other are doing? And please, this is open for the group, so anybody would like to jump in.
To some extent, it's dependent upon the patient, actually to the largest extent. Someone may come in as an opiate overdose, and the medicine aspect of that's pretty easy. We can revive them and monitor them, and of course we're going to talk to them about community resources that are available. Oftentimes they're not interested in hearing it, and I have no mechanism to force them to do so, obviously. Sometimes we do have people that come in and say, I'm addicted to opiates, I want to get clean. And that's a great opportunity to use our community partnerships to get those people referrals and get them into some sort of program. Now, sometimes people come with somewhat unrealistic or expectations about what our resources truly are. For instance, can you admit me to the hospital, detox me, or send me to an inpatient treatment center or something like that? And the fact of the matter is they're just aren't that many resources available to accomplish that.
Candy, how are most of your referrals? I mean, when people come to Heritage, you know, how are they arriving? From where?
From wherever. But what they do right now is they arrive, if we don't know they're coming ahead of time, they're right in open access. And we're getting 15 to 20 people a day in our open access. Probably half of those are for addiction. And we just don't have the resources as far as detox beds and rehab beds to serve them. Those are full most of the time. The detox beds and the rehab beds are full most of the time. So we don't have them to serve there. We can try to serve them in outpatient, but a lot of times that's not the level they need. And then they get lost. If they just have to come to outpatient, you have to count on them to get there by themselves. They kind of lose the momentum.
Does anyone have an idea how many, I mean, if you could wave a wand and create treatment centers and beds, how many we would even need in a community?
That's a difficult question to answer because every one of the surrounding communities around us is operating with a deficient number of beds. And so no matter how big of a resource we place in this community, we'll fill it with our needs and then folks will come from other communities. That's how great this problem is in the entire country.
It was interesting. Something I read that was posted on Center for Disease Control's website is that the rates of opioid dependence are much higher in micropolitan areas, small towns like Decatur. You know, it may not be a problem, as big of a problem in Decatur, but yet it's not showing the rates are higher in small towns. The explanation in this article was that people from rural areas seek health care in these small towns. I don't know whether that's true, but that was what was included in this article. I thought that was interesting.
Tanya, can you tell me a little bit about the Betty Ford Foundation and
yes.
A couple of grants that you've been successful at getting and what success has come with that?
Right. So we're a federally qualified health center, and it makes us eligible to write for federal grants. 2 years ago, we wrote for a grant put forth by HRSA to bring in total $800,000 to Macon County over a two-year period to set up a medication-assisted treatment program to treat the opioid epidemic. The evidence very clearly shows that unless you have a medication to assist detoxification, people typically are not successful in coming off of opioids. And so the idea was to establish the infrastructure to serve more people. With those dollars, we were starting something new. Heritage had done the methadone program for a number of years, but in our community, we did not have the resources or the prescribers for Suboxone and Vivitrol. So with those dollars, we decided we needed to make a significant investment into education for our medical staff and our treatment partners, Heritage as well. So we brought the Betty Ford Foundation on site to Decatur. They spent a week here training our staff, the staff at Heritage, and Tony Brown stopped in from the Sheriff's Department and several people stopped in from the Decatur Police Department, went through this training, and then they provide us ongoing support. So Dr. Dana Ray, who is the head prescriber for the medication-assisted treatment program, routinely touches base with the experts at Betty Ford to make sure that the treatment that we're providing is on target with the evidence and to help answer very complex questions. These patients are very sick. They've had many years of abusing their body, so there's multi-systems that are affected, and then you're giving these other medications alongside, so medically they're often very complicated to treat. And so it's a resource that those federal grant dollars have afforded us in the community to make sure that the treatment that we're providing is top-notch.
Tim and Joan, we haven't talked about, you know, the other health conditions. I mean, with the more use of needles, you know, the numbers of hepatitis C, you know, go up. Are you seeing correlating numbers and increases in those illnesses and diseases as well?
I would not confirm that.
Okay.
What I would say is that I view mental and behavioral health and addiction truly as a chronic disease. And I think that if we are able to treat it, identify and treat it more upstream, we're able to better get our arms around this. You know, what I really love about this panel is that it's collaborative. There are people from all constituent groups, because it's going to take each and every one of us to address this from multiple aspects, whether it's, you know, QPR training, question, persuade, and refer, so that we can introduce that to the schools, to the community, so that they can identify and respond to someone who might need care and access to care and treatment. I think, too, the other piece of this, when we think about the state of Wisconsin, going back to an example that they did, in terms of access to treatment, they put together a call center so that as patients were introduced to the emergency departments, should they need placement for treatment, there was a call center that was statewide. You could identify where open beds might be available. Again, I can't reemphasize enough how important it is that we approach this very collaboratively. When Tanya speaks to, you know, we really need addictionologists. When you think about who's going to help us manage these patients, it's not just the ER, it's not just law enforcement. When you think about medication-assisted therapy, we need addictionologists to really help us with that. One of the things Governor Walker did was add fellowship slots to enable us to have more physicians in the pipeline to support the addictionology piece. So I think it's important that we come together very collaboratively and identify and prioritize what are those things we need to do short-term and long-term and work together to figure that out.
Debbie, can you talk a little bit about 2-on-1 and maybe the importance of that as far as connecting dots and services and finding beds?
Right. So 2-on-1 is an information referral phone number that you can call to for really any type of service that you might need, social service. And it can be used for this type of thing as well. Again, if there's no beds open, then there's some issues there. For instance, Brick House Foundation that opened back in June or July, you know, they're full. They have 16 beds. They're full. Of the 16 beds, 15 of those are from people out of Macon County. Because as soon as a bed opens up really anywhere, I mean, everybody has waiting lists. People are trying to get into these. So if there's no beds available, it does create issues with that. But we can also tailor 2-on-1 to address situations in our community that are unique or not unique, but because we can ask questions when somebody calls in. So we could do it so that every single person that calls into 2-on-1, at the end of the conversation, we ask, we can frame the questions however we want, but would you like some information on prescription addiction? You know, those types of things, and refer them or send them information. Like, we can start that conversation right there, and, you know, they may say no, or, you know, yes, it may spark something in them to want help or get a little more information on that. So there's a lot of things that we can do with this to personalize it to fit this topic.
Sheriff Buffett, you've been talking to people all over the country, you know, that are dealing with these same issues, some more than others. Is there anyone out there that has a successful model that you have found?
Well, there's different models, and we've got our at-risk officer. He's we had somebody come up from Florida to talk to us about their program. He went back to Maryland. But I want to give you, you know, you've heard about how the bed issue is a challenge and the resources are a challenge. I want to give you a different way to look at this that I don't think most people in this room would think about it this way, and I wouldn't have, except I was talking to the former director of the DEA not too long ago, and he said to me, he says, you know, we know a good part of the cartel's business plan. And I hadn't thought about the cartel having a business plan, but they are a business. They're a hundreds of billions of dollars business. So let me tell you something that he said to me that I would never have thought of, honestly. He said, the communities that lack the resources are clearly in their business plan to target. So when Decatur doesn't have enough beds, they know they can sell more heroin. When Springfield, Illinois doesn't have enough beds, they know they can sell more heroin. So it isn't just an issue that we can't address the needs of our citizens. It's an issue, it's a bigger issue, and it's an issue that we become a target. And you can't, this is not in the abstract. This is a reality. This is why we're having the problem. And you can go back and look at how this developed east of us, and it has to do with the distribution channels from the cartel, and it has to do with that combining with the pill mills that were established and some of the doctors that decided to get rich off of selling opioids the wrong way, and those things combined. So if you look, if you go to the west right now, if you look at L.A., the police chief will tell you that his problem is still crack cocaine and meth. In Omaha, Nebraska, they'll tell you it's crack cocaine and meth. Okay, that is gonna change. This is flowing, clearly flowing, east to west, and we're just starting to get on the edge of it, in my opinion. It's gonna get worse before it gets better. Somehow, we have to find, I don't know where the money comes from when you look at the situation that the state's in, but it's a two-edged sword because we don't have the ability to take care of the people that need the help. And I'm telling you, we will see this come in a much stronger way than we've seen it yet.
And what do you think that timeline is?
It's happening now. I think it's happening now here. For a long time, we have bought Narcan for about five or six police or sheriff agencies. And I kept telling them in Omaha, because I know the police chief, you know, we'll buy you Narcan. We don't need it. We'll buy you Narcan. We don't need it. So I sent them an article and I said, here's a couple of canine dogs that would have died if, because Narcan can work on the canines. He said, you know what? Maybe we'll take some of that for some of our guys that are in special. So they took a lot more than just a little bit. And then he sent me an email 2 weeks ago, and he said, you know, we saved the first life with the Narcan. He said, so I wrote him. I said, well, what's different? You know, you didn't want it. I didn't say it quite like this, but you know, you didn't want it 3 months ago. And he said, we're seeing it. It's showing up. I mean, it is coming. And so, I don't think anybody has an answer. That's the scary part. I honestly think that's the scary part because we know what we need to do, but finding the resources to do it. And everybody at this table pretty much has sat down and talked to each other about it. And the next move is to do exactly what you touched on, which is to do a better job of sharing information and then using that information to figure out how we get more aggressive about this. So I think it's pretty scary.
Jay, I read a quote in a story, I believe, in the paper a couple of days ago about how now you're seeing this every day, where it was an occasional thing 7-8 years ago. Now it is an everyday crossing your desk.
Even going back farther than that, I was a drug prosecutor for 10 years. And since I've gotten elected, I review all the felony cases. And it was in the old days, if you saw heroin, it's like, wow, heroin in Decatur. And now we're either seeing heroin or black market prescription pills, I'd say daily. Definitely every week, if not every day.
And does that coincide with the county and the city? I mean, are you seeing it across, you know, all demographic lines?
Yes, and we have people coming from little towns to Decatur to get their drugs, both any kind of opioid. So we're kind of a little mecca here for the surrounding area.
And you take it past the victims we've been talking about tonight, which are the opioid users themselves. Chief Getz, I'm sure you can attest that much of the shooting that's happened this year is, you know, in and around drugs or drug dealing. I mean, all of this is interconnected.
Absolutely. When you have drug trade, it involves money and particular gang members and people dealing drugs, they get particular about their money and are very protective. So violence is associated with it, no doubt about it. One other thing that we need to keep in mind is the synthetic opioids. They're here in Decatur. We had recovered some heroin over the summer, sent it to the state crime lab for testing. and it came back as a synthetic. And so I've talked to the chief over in Urbana. They had a overdose about a month ago, and when they recovered what drugs were left, it was 100% synthetic opioids. So those are here too, and those are much more powerful than just the heroin.
Do you think most people would be surprised the amount of drugs that move through here, either stopping here or moving somewhere else? I mean, would your average citizen that doesn't do what you guys do for a living be stunned?
I look at semi-trucks when they go along the interstate, and I think which one of those is packed with either $1 million going west or $10 million worth of fentanyl or cocaine or something going to Chicago. I mean, the amount of drugs being moved, I mean, we have a great interstate system. And then when you start putting pressure on the interstate, we have a great highway system. I mean, the interdiction, and I'll tell you another thing that is going to affect law enforcement and drug interdiction in a huge way. And there was a court case that came down on an appeals court in the Colorado. I can't think of what district that is. I'm sure Jay knows. But and so now you can no longer in Colorado, as a drug interdiction officer, run your dog, your canine, on a vehicle because it is trained to hit on marijuana. And since marijuana is legal, so all I got to do is put 50 pounds of cocaine in my trunk and that dog hits on my car and I go, hey, man, I just smoked some marijuana, but, you know, it was a while back. It's in my clothes and I'm legal. And you cannot search that vehicle. The impact that's going to have across this country on drug interdiction, it is amazing. Because I'm going to tell you, when you get drugs, you get guns and you get cash. You get all three. And, you know, I think that as we legalize marijuana, there's a whole other topic, and I don't want to get sidetracked on it, but it will have unintended consequences to law enforcement and our ability to fight this. So as we are fighting a wave of drugs and opioids that are hitting us hard, we are going to have tools taken away from us.
All right, I want to start at the end of the panel and give every one of you a chance for some closing remarks and quite frankly to add anything that I was not smart enough to ask tonight because you guys do this for a living.
Brian, that list is too long.
So I would like to start down at our far end with Mary Garrison, professor of social work here at Millikan University.
I think what I would like to say in my closing remarks is the need for that integrated education and treatment that happens between mental health and addiction. We have high rates of depression and anxiety with individuals on bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, of individuals that are using opioids and in self-medicating across the board. And our clinicians need to be educated not only in the beginning through what we're doing here, right, and through graduate school ongoing. You were just talking about how different this is changing all the time. You know, we're talking about marijuana years ago, heroin, okay, and now here we are. Our clinicians need to be trained ongoing and be able to connect with law enforcement. And when I think about that clinicians that I work with, they are surprised at the beginning about, wow, who are we seeing? And then they're not, because it's all the time. And they are talented. They, you know, are doing their very best. But when you don't have that knowledge base and you're trained professionally because we're not sure what that crisis is, and then we need to do a better job of that. I firmly believe that is kind of my passion there on addressing that. So,
Dr. Joe Carter, Associate Professor of Nursing, Millikan University.
I can't help but put on my public health hat a little bit. Something we haven't really talked a lot about today is thinking upstream. You know, the ideal thing would be to prevent this from happening to begin with. And some believe that substance use issues in communities is related to having a market for it. So what if we remove the market? You know, an educated, happy, and healthy community is going to be pretty resilient and resistant to any type of substance abuse kinds of things, and a little thornier to deal with, but something to think about.
Thank you. Candy Clevenger with Heritage Behavioral Health Center.
Yes. We've seen this change from cocaine and crack being one-third of our population to opioid taking over the one-third. And it just seems to be really a demand in the in our area. And we have the detox unit, which handles some of the patients, residential, but we also have a lot of outpatient, and then just more needs for that kind of thing, but also the need for long-term recovery to be able to support the clients as they leave. You know, they come in and they go through a short treatment and they really need to be supported better in the community and have other things like their poverty issues, their housing, their education, their job readiness, all those other things to help them, you know, make a difference in their lives and help them through their recovery.
Thank you. Tanya Andrix, Director of Crossings Healthcare.
My job is to bring resources to this community to deal with healthcare crisis just like this, specifically to the low-income population, which is the most vulnerable. And so in the last year and a half, as we've brought resources and started to battle this, one thing that I've seen that makes me feel better is that people can get help and they can get better. So if you're listening to this broadcast and this is affecting you, seek help. Call for help. I know the window is oftentimes very narrow for someone when they finally do decide that they can get help. And so it's very hard. And if you're a family member, it's a very difficult thing to watch. But people have successfully battled opioid addictions and are on the other side throughout our community. There's example after example. And so, you know, this is a difficult conversation, and we're looking at it from a countywide perspective, but on the individual basis. People can get better, they can get help, and the treatments are effective when they're implemented and when the person's ready. And so I would say if you need assistance to call your care provider. If you can't, if you don't have a care provider, 877-9117 is Crossing Healthcare, and we'll try to connect you.
Thank you. Debbie Bogle, United Way.
Along those same lines, I just want to highlight 211 again, that service is available if you don't know where to go for help, whether it be for this specific situation or anything that is an effect of the situation, drug abuse, that you can call this number and find the services that are out there in our community that can help you. This covers five counties, the 211 system, and it goes beyond our county as well. So if there's not a service here, for one of the issues that you're facing, it will direct you to the closest city that has that service so that we can help find those services that you need.
Sheriff Buffett.
Well, this is going to take billions of dollars to address, and there's not any easy way to get that except, and I hate to say this because it's going to help lawyers, but we have to do what is already starting on track, which is to sue the pharmaceutical companies, get a settlement out of those and the distributors who started this problem or helped contribute to this problem. I shouldn't say started it. That's and use that money for primarily rehabilitation, but also education, because I don't believe that you're going to get anywhere by the comment that was made earlier. I mean, I can tell you I met with the company in New York that manufactures in El Salvador. And if you can believe this, this is where we've gotten. This company is closing five plants in the United States, not because labor is cheaper, but because they cannot keep a labor force that can pass a drug test. So they can move them to El Salvador, and in 1 year of absenteeism in El Salvador, they have in 1 month in their plants. If you think we can solve this by and this may be the law enforcement coming out, but I've also seen the reality of this. There will be black markets. You're not going to have a business that is trillions of dollars go away by trying to legalize it. And you will have people who will drive bulldozers and drive trucks. And if they are impaired by drugs, if that's the direction this society wants to go, we're headed in a really tough direction.
Thank you, Sheriff. Chief Goetz.
Sitting here tonight, I think everybody realizes what a challenge this is. And you can also maybe look bigger picture. These countries that are sending this stuff into our country, they know what they're doing. They know that they're eating us from the inside out. They don't have to come over and drop a bomb on us or do a terrorist event. I mean, this is tearing us up from the inside out, not only physically to our people, but the financial strain that this will put on the United States to fix this epidemic is huge. So what we can do at the local level is we have a group of stakeholders here. We have to all be rowing that boat in the same direction. If I'm out trying to cut off the supply, but we're not giving enough treatment, or we're issuing too much opioids at the emergency room, we're not going to get it done. We have to be rowing the boat in the same direction, and that will help us a little bit locally, and that's the way we're going to have to attack it.
Maine County State's Attorney Jay Scott.
Well, Brian, first, I guess I want to say thank you personally and everybody else that had a hand in putting this together. It's an important topic of conversation. I want to thank all of you for coming out as well. A lot of people weren't aware of what was going on, and it's going to have to be a community effort and a nationwide effort to combat this.
Tim Stone, President and CEO of Decatur Memorial Hospital.
I think if everyone was paid attention, there was one speaker that I think has laid out the path forward, and that was Tanya Andrix. We can't wait for the federal government to show up. We can't wait for politicians to suddenly say, oh, my gosh, the public electorate is registering their dissatisfaction at the ballot box. We don't. It's people like Crossing, and Jim Getz said it as well. We have to take control of our own destiny. We have to come together. We have to develop a degree of self-reliance and resilience based upon the services and the resources that we have available in the community. And we have to do that now. And I applaud WSOY and Brian because this is the first step in that direction. We've done some very positive things in this community. Both ourselves, St. Mary's, and Crossing have worked very hard to ensure that some of the basic needs of patients are met. Specifically, that the model of care has to always be that everyone is assigned to a primary care physician because it begins there. Now, that's not possible in all cases, but for the most part, I think we've created some basic fundamental foundation that we can start building upon, and we all have to collectively come together to achieve that.
Dr. Ted Clark, Medical Director of DMH Emergency Care Center.
I share Mr. Stone's optimism. We have put forward plans in the emergency department, and this is something that's been talked about nationally among emergency physicians and our governing bodies, to limit the use of opiates. If we can keep someone from coming into contact with it and potentially stop that addiction before it occurs, I think that's the best that we can do as healthcare providers in the emergency department. So putting those tools into place to make that work is the path forward for us.
Joan Kaufman, President and CEO of HSHS St. Mary's Hospital.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you again for inviting us here this evening. I just want to say I'm very proud of the community. We recognize, you know, when you think about addiction, the first step in treatment is recognizing that you have a problem. And I think for us to be here tonight to really work with the community and really identify and prioritize our way out in terms of next steps is going to be vitally important, and sooner rather than later, because I agree with Sheriff Buffett that it is here. It is probably an undercurrent that we don't recognize every day, but it's our children that we really want to create a better future for. So together, I think we can get ahead of this.
Dr. John Berry, Director of St. Mary's Pain Medicine Center.
Yes, it seems that we have several phases here. The first phase is prevention, and then the second phase is monitoring of opioid-treated patients and monitoring of much illegal opioids coming into the community, because the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine has put out this report. It's a small little town here that basically indicates that as we limit prescription opioids, is squeezing the balloon. It's going to cause a increasing hunger, need, and market, if you will, for heroin and illegal opioids, synthetics and otherwise. So we need to understand that as well and hopefully continue to treat chronic pain patients in a humane fashion, even given this opioid crisis. One person who's not at the table is an addictionist. And what the audience may not know is that you need a special license to be an addictionist. It is a special corner of medicine, and the addictionists are actually limited in their license in how many patients can they treat. So you have to have many more addictionists if we continue this limit, arbitrary limits on how many patients an addictionist can treat. So that's the third phase, is treatment. Once we've identified a problem, is get that treatment. And we need to basically demand
the funding.
I would like to thank everyone for being here tonight. I want to thank HSHS St. Mary's Hospital and Decatur Memorial Hospital for jointly sponsoring this event tonight, commercial free for the entire hour. How about a big round of applause for our panel? Also, a special thank you to Millikan University for hosting us tonight in this brand new University Commons building. If anybody missed any part of this broadcast, there will be a podcast of this available at natdecatur.com and a full video as well. So feel free to share on social media and help us share the message. This is just step one, a very, very early conversation about what we know and what we don't know. So thank you for being here tonight and thank you for listening.
I got a question.